Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. This is just one segment of today's show. You can hear all of our conversations about New York's vibrant cultural scene on demand at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found, was blind, but now can see.
Well, you know the song, but this version might not be familiar yet. It's from the new album by Ladysmith Black Mambazo with their guest Emmylou Harris. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. For 20 years, Americans have recognized the voices of Ladysmith Black Mambazo as the Sound of Freedom. It was their historic collaboration with Paul Simon on the Graceland record, 6 years before apartheid was dismantled in South Africa, that brought this a cappella group and Umbakonga music to the masses around the world. Since then, Ladysmith has become a part of the American music scene, and obviously they've picked up some of our sounds along the way. Their new album is called Long Walk to Freedom, features appearances by Melissa Etheridge, Emmylou Harris, Taj Mahal, and others, and it brings the founder and leader of Ladysmith Black Mambazo, Joseph Shabalala, back to our studios. Good to see you again.
Thank you very much to be back here again. When I listen to this song, remember, this song was introduced by Paul Simon to us, and we learned the song from him. And other guys, they said, we used to had this song at home. People were singing Amazing Grace, and I love the song.
I'm surprised that you hadn't heard it before Paul Simon brought it to you, because so much South African music seems to have roots in American gospel music. A lot of, gospel and spiritual music was
exactly right. But at that time, I was a farm boy, away from the township, away from the cities. And then when I came there, I have an idea of doing something. And then Paul Simon, I know, Joseph, you know this song, Amazing. I said, familiar, but I don't know the name of the song. Yeah. My guys, they said, yeah, we had that.
So this was about 20 years ago that he introduced you to the song.
Exactly.
And now here you are recording it with Emmylou Harris.
All right.
The album is called Long Walk to Freedom. Apartheid has been gone in South Africa for many years now. Is that long walk still going on?
Long walk to freedom is still going on, because now we are free, but we're still inviting friends, and then we can enjoy many things with our friends in and out, because many things was just like fallen down, fallen apart. Now we need our friends. Long walk to freedom.
Now, when you say friends, do you mean, neighboring countries in South Africa? Do you mean white and black people within South Africa?
No, I mean everywhere outside America, Europe, Japan. Mm-hmm. People must come together and see and help us, especially 2010 is coming. We need friends to come and build their houses. We can rent that, going closer to everywhere, in Johannesburg, in Durban, Ladysmith. We want to build the academy. Mm-hmm. Yes, working very hard.
What's the significance of 2010? Is that a particularly significant? Why do you mention that year in particular?
I mention that because many people are coming. We invite every person, black and white, Indians and colored, everywhere to come to South Africa, because I think that day would be a history of African to come together with other people. They have many things. They have many, dreams to build things and to extend South Africa, to work together with everyone.
Mm. All right, so it sounds like things have changed, but that there are still a lot of other changes afoot. The type of music that you have done all these years, which I say Umbakanga, please correct me.
You are right, exactly.
Umbakanga, there you go.
But the music I sing is Atamiya, tiptoe music.
Tiptoe, okay.
Yes,
so
yes.
Because Umbakanga can be a little more electric, a little more amplified.
Exactly, Umbakanga, yeah.
Right.
You know how to say it.
I know how to say it, but I cannot say it. So I can't get that click in the middle. But this was music of change. Is it still a music of change? Are you still advocating for social causes and things like that in your music?
In my music, we try to comfort the people, because it's just like a long time ago, there are many sores in our body, in our mind, in our spirit. Now this music is the music to comfort the people, to come together, forgive one another. Long way to freedom. You know that on the way, we just step one another on our feet, and maybe he's still angry of me. And I said, no, let's go together now. This is the time to forgive one another.
All right, we're speaking with Joseph Shabalala, the founder and leader of the world-famous African choir known as Ladysmith Black Mambazo. I mentioned you first came to international fame when Paul Simon had the group on the album Graceland. The new record features you revisiting one of the songs from the Graceland album. The song is Diamonds on the Soles of Her Shoes.
I love that song from the beginning when Paul Simon introduced that song to me, and then he said, Joseph, could you please, he say this, bless this song. I said, Paul, this song is okay now. And he said, no, say something. And I say something in Zulu. Akujwayelekile kanjalo kodwa ezinsukwini zanamhlanje sibona kwenzeka kanjalo. She's a rich girl. She don't try to watch. I just answer that.
So that's a blessing.
Yes.
Okay.
To bless the song, yeah.
Well, the song did pretty well, so you must have done something right there.
Thank you.
Now we hear the new version from Ladysmith Black Mambazo with Melissa Etheridge. The song is Diamonds on the Soles of Her Shoes.
People say she's crazy, she's got diamonds on the soles of her shoes. Well, that's one way to lose. Soles of her shoes. She was physically forgotten when she slipped into my pocket with my car keys. She says, you've taken me for granted because I please you. Wearing these diamonds. And I can say, ooh. As if everybody knows what I am talking about, as if everybody here would know exactly what I was talking about. Talking about diamonds on the soles of her shoes.
That's Ladysmith Black Mambazo with special guest Melissa Etheridge and a version of Diamonds on the Soles of Her Shoes, which was originally on the Paul Simon record Graceland. We're speaking with Joseph Shabalala, founder and leader of Ladysmith Black Mambazo. And Joseph, you co-wrote that song with Paul, right?
He allows me to do that. And then I bless the song. I just take my pen and then write only four lines.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just teach my guys to get in. I said, yes, she's a rich girl, but all along, early times, the girls used to stay at home. But nowadays, they have their money. They are rich.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So what was the, what was the meaning of the song? Did it have any kind of resonance back home in South Africa when people heard that? Was there a message to the song?
Oh, yes. The message to the song was encouraging that ladies, they are allowed to work very hard now and maintain themselves. That was a beautiful song everywhere. Even today, if you can take one thing, diamonds on the soles of a shoe. People say, I'm crazy, we've got diamonds on the soles of a shoe. So, oh, yeah. And people said, yes, yes, yes. They love it.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, it's interesting because Ladysmith Black Mambazo is an all-male chorus.
Yes.
Why is that?
I can tell you the story. It's because, you see, when you leave your home away from the town, on the farm, the lady must be at home, take care of the home. And the man must go and work very hard and come back with something to maintain the home. But as the time goes, the ladies now are allowed to go to the town and work. And then they started to join this music tiptoe, guys. It's Atamiya. You'll find the ladies there. Black Mambazo, in the early time, there were ladies.
Really?
Oh, yes. But they failed because it was not easy. The dream in my head was a little bit tough to the people who I teach them.
Mm-hmm.
And later on, when they caught this dream, everybody who was there said, oh, I was there. I wish I'm still supposed to be still there. But the dream goes on and on.
So other choruses, other groups now have women in them.
Oh, yes.
Ladysmith Black Mambazo for many years has been, well, basically it's a family group, isn't it? It's a lot of your family, and there's one other family that has three or four members in the band as well.
Exactly, you're right. Even today, nowadays, my sons are there, four of them. Yeah, they were in school, they finished school, they work. And then I discovered that they need somebody. I was trying to get somebody. And the mother told me that they love to join you.
Hmm.
I was calling another person. Hey, there's a space here. Do you have a place to live around here in Durban? I know your voice is good. You can come and join us. But you have no place. And the mother said, no. Don't worry about the people. Here, you have people.
Just look in the kids' rooms upstairs.
You'll find look at them. I know that they are good, but yeah. I thought they would say, working with father, it would be hard. They love me. They come and join. Even nowadays, they must come and do interviews here because they know everything better than Mambazo.
Uh-huh.
They know even the time when I sing alone in the room and take the tape and say something. They said, what is he doing?
What are you doing? Is that how you write?
Oh, yes.
The tape recorder?
Oh, yes. The tape recorder helps me a lot. But nowadays, from the beginning, it was just like somebody was writing in my head.
Hmm.
But now it's many songs. I need a tape.
We're speaking with Joseph Shabalala from the band Ladysmith Black Mambazo. In addition to collaborating with Americans on the new record, Long Walk to Freedom, we've already heard a little bit from Emmylou Harris and Melissa Etheridge. There are also a number of other African guests, like Lucky Dube and just a whole host of others. Hugh Masekela.
It changed to be like Black Mambazo have done a good thing. Hugh Masekela was, we were trying to get together for a long time ago. I remember in the Paul Simon's office, he was playing the organ, and then we were trying to sing with him, but because we were busy. I'm glad that the promoters now, they come back, the managers, they come back, give us a time.
So this is an opportunity after many, many years to collaborate.
Many, many, yes.
The song is called Shosholoza, and it features a lot of guests. There's like half a dozen different guests joining Ladysmith Black Mambazo, so it's like a party of sorts.
Exactly. This song has a story. Only the politicians can tell you what does it mean to them, and we can tell you what does it mean to us musicians.
All right, let's hear a little bit, and then we'll ask Joseph Shabalala what it means to him. The song is called Shosholoza. It's from Ladysmith Black Mambazo's latest record, Long Walk to Freedom. You can hear Hugh Masekela's trumpet, Lucky Dubé, and a host of other guests. All right, Joseph, you said only a politician could tell you what it means to him.
Yes.
What does the story of this song mean to you?
The story, it gives me the power to express myself to the people, to tell them what I think. Because I'm a musician, I just tell them in my music. And the politicians, it means social laws. Let's do it. Let's do it good and nice. Don't run away. Come back home.
So is this seen as a political song back home in South Africa?
It's a political song to the politicians. It's a beautiful song to those musicians because it encourages you to do what you want to do. Don't let nobody to disturb you to do it.
Now, this is a topic that you've had to talk about a lot, and I know we've talked about it a little bit before too, that in South Africa, just the act of being a musician at one point made you a political figure, whether you wanted to be or not. And you know, there's that kind of strange, it seems you have a, you would prefer not to be considered a political figure. Is that fair to say?
Exactly, you're right. But I find myself in. I prefer to be not. I used to say the stage is for those people who are fighting on that way. My stage, they don't come and disturb me. They just not go on stage and sing with me because they're going to make a mistake. I don't want to go to them and say something to the people because I'm not trained of that. I'm trained to be a musician.
And yet, you know, tragedy has hit the band and you personally over the years. I mean, you mentioned having openings in the band, those have occurred when members of the band who were members of your family died. Your wife had been murdered by a masked gunman shortly before we spoke last time.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you think there that any of that has anything to do with your standing in the culture there, with, you know, with this whole equation of being a musician and having something political to say?
I think the harmony and those lyrics of peace, love, and harmony, it says to all, when I say ANC, IFP, so-and-so, come together in peace.
So you're referring to the different political parties in South Africa?
Yeah, there's a song which says that they love it.
Mm-hmm.
But some of them are a little bit saying that you're supposed to begin with.
Mm.
Oh, I said, no. This is the one. ANC, that is the first political.
Mm-hmm.
And then IFP come from ANC because they stopped the name. They boycotted the name. And then I include all of them. you are doing the same thing. Don't fight.
Yeah, I guess it's almost impossible to sort of wade into those waters without getting, you know, I can understand why you don't like to be viewed as a political figure, whatever may come with it. And it does seem like you continue to have a lot to say. The new album, Long Walk to Freedom, says it in several languages, which
exactly.
is what Ladysmith...
Long Walk to Freedom.
Ladysmith Black Mambazo's latest album features the voices of Joseph Shabalala and the members of this great South African chorus, but also featuring guests like Taj Mahal, Emmylou Harris, Melissa Etheridge, Lucky Dube, and others. This is one of the most famous pieces of South African music. You have Taj Mahal helping out on the song Mbube, which we also know here as Wimowe, and we also know it as The Lion Sleeps Tonight, but this is kind of going back to the original version from the 1930s. All right, Joseph Shabalala, always a pleasure to see you. Thanks for stopping by Soundcheck this afternoon.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here. It's just like my home now.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. You know the old saying, what's in a name? Well, in the case of rock bands, everything from hastily chosen inside jokes to carefully selected literary references. Some band names are pretty straightforward. ABBA is an acronym formed by the members' first initials. But others, like Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah, are deliberately enigmatic. Joining us today is Adam Dulgens. He's the author of the book Band Names, From ABBA to ZZ Top, and he'll take us through some of the better and lesser-known examples, and we'll take some calls as well. Adam, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks for having me.
So, rule of thumb, should a band's name express something about their music?
There is no real rule of thumb. Certainly there are many bands who have tried to say something very important, and others have deliberately tried to subvert that. You know, they pick names that are deliberately vague and don't pigeonhole them. So, and sometimes that, you know, when a band comes up with what they think is the perfect name, it kind of backfires. And sometimes the haphazard name that was chosen at the last minute turns out to be brilliant and opens doors because people want to know what does that mean.
Yeah. It strikes me that, you know, back in the day, if you were, a regular on the punk scene here in New York, there was a band that would occasionally play at some of the clubs, and their name would be listed in the paper as The Sick F**KS.
Yes.
And it always struck me that, number one, that was a name that kind of told you what kind of music to expect,
sure.
But number two also meant that this band would never get played on the radio. So
right.
the choice of name was a real hindrance to them.
Absolutely. Unless they, you know, were sort of anti-commercial and they didn't care about that, you know.
All right, but let's assume that you're forming a band and you don't want to drive away any possibility of getting some kind of media exposure. Can a good name do that for you? Can it help you that way?
I think it can. I mean, you know, well, you mentioned, I think you mentioned Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah, or at least we were discussing that earlier.
Yep.
You know, that either turns people off or it makes people say, well, I'm curious, I want to check that out. And I think now, in sort of the internet era, when there's just sort of a sea of bands that you have access to, a catchy name that might make you want to click and at least listen to
okay.
the band. So,
well, it's funny because in London's Independent, they recently noted a trend towards band names based on rock and roll exclamations like the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, the Shout Out Louds, 5678s, and they included Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah,
right.
Which is not where they got the name of that band. I mean, we've had the lead singer and founder of that band here on the show, and basically that they were going to their first gig. They didn't have a name. They look out the window. There's a Brooklyn warehouse, and somebody has scrawled the graffiti, Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah, across the wall of the building.
There's a long history of that. That's a time-honored tradition of, you know, the band Bread said they were stuck behind a bread truck making a delivery. And, you know, even you know, like the Rolling Stones, you know, it's a Muddy Waters reference. But, you know, Keith Richards said it was completely haphazard. They were on the phone with the local paper. They had to, you know, place their ad for one of their early gigs. And the woman said, well, what's your name? And they hadn't really locked in on a name. And he said, you know, he just looked down and there was Brian was on the phone. He was sort of probably on the floor. And, you know, there was the album and he just.
The Muddy Waters album.
Yeah, the Muddy Waters album. He said, well, how about that? And he said, you know, just like everything they've done, it was somewhat haphazard, but somehow it was the right name.
Actually, I had read many, many years ago that for a brief spell, the Stones were the Silver Rolling Stones. And if I'm not mistaken, the Beatles at some point were toying with the name the Silver Beatles.
I didn't hear about the Stones, but I do know the Beatles were the Silver Beatles. Originally, John came up with the name with the Beatles, and he told another more successful band on the Liverpool scene, what do you think of this name? And he said, that's far too short. You need a name like Long John and the Silver Beatles, something that really kind of fills the marquee and gets attention. And so briefly, I think they did perform under that name. And, you know, of course, the Beatles was just a kind of a silly pun on beat music. And it was a reference to the Crickets, who, it turns out, you know, they actually considered calling themselves the Beatles because they picked their name out of an encyclopedia and came to an insect page. But they decided that the Beatles are just something you want to step on. And they chose the Crickets because it was more musical.
But the Beatles went with the other bug and just changed the spelling, as you say, as an allusion to beat poetry and stuff.
And beat music. And the thing is, you know, I don't think we think about the pun. I mean, who thinks even about the name? When you're successful, it doesn't matter what the name is.
Exactly.
You know, it's unimportant.
And yet, many of us have had the experience of listening to a band and saying, where did they come up with that name?
Sure.
And so we're going to go to the phones. We'll open up the phones. And if you've ever had that experience with a rock band, you can call Adam up and we've got the book here and you can. We'll see if Adam can help you out. The number is 212-264-7483. 212-264-7483. Adam Dolgen's book is called Band Names, From ABBA to ZZ Top. And when did you first write the book?
The first edition came out in 93, and I've done two additional editions. But the last one came out in 98, so if it's any very recent band, I may know the story, I may not. So
okay.
I'm certainly stumpable.
So if I throw out, and you will know us by our Trail of Dead, nice name, but you don't know the backstory on that one.
You know, that is one of the names that sort of nags at me. It gnaws at me, and I say, you know, when you're reading the paper or you're online and you see certain names, you have to know. At least I have to know.
Okay.
There are others I just kind of, you know, the White Stripes, okay, you know, but a band like that, you know, you really want to know the story.
I would be quite curious. So that'll have to be for edition four of Adam Dolgen's book. Let's start with Patrick here in Manhattan. Patrick, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hi, thank you very much. I am one of the most interesting band names that struck me was Death Cab for Cutie. I'm sure Adam would have something to say about that.
As I understand it, it comes from the Bonzo Dog Doodah band, or probably I'm mangling their name, the band in the 60s.
Exactly, because when I heard that name, they basically were an arts band. People basically said that they were sort of like the British Mothers of Invention at the time.
Right.
But I know Paul McCartney really liked them, and he had to convince John Lennon to get them to perform in Magical Mystery Tour.
Right.
And they performed Death Cab for Cutie in Magical Mystery Tour. They were the band during the striptease scene.
Uh-huh.
And what's interesting about the band, it was formed by Vivian Stanchel and Neil Innes.
Of Monty Python fame.
Yes. And they just released these DVDs of a show called Do Not Adjust Your Set, which came out. 10 episodes, and it featured Eric Idle, Terry Jones, and Michael Palin.
Hmm.
And then 6 months later, they went on to perform Monty Python. But the house band on these shows is the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band. And, of course, we know because of the relationship between Neil Innes and Eric Idle, they went on to form not only the Lumberjack song and all those and Spamalot songs, but also the Ruddles.
The Ruddles, yeah.
Right.
So it's interesting that it has a name that has a piece of British comedy history.
It's got a lot going for it. All right, Patrick, that's a good start. Thank you for the call. And let's move along then to Stuart in Brooklyn. Stuart, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Great. I love the topic of the show, and I couldn't let the thing go by without bringing up bands like Steely Dan and 10cc that have wonderfully obscene names that folks won't necessarily know by hearing them.
Yes. Well, it's interesting. Steely Dan is a reference to, let's say, a sexual aid in a William Burroughs novel, Naked Lunch. And it was it squirted milk. And so, that was... I guess a very subversive reference because, you know, if you just hear the name Steely Dan, you might think, oh, that's maybe their cat or, you know, a roadie or something like that. And then when you find out what the reference really is, you know, you see sort of the sinister side of that. and it perhaps makes the band more interesting. And 10cc, you know, that's one of those bands that had sort of lots of rumors swirling about the name. But according to, I think it was Jonathan King, the British impresario who managed the band. They're originally called, I think they're called Hot Legs. Maybe I'm thinking of some other band. But he said in a dream, he dreamt that he was managing a band that had a simultaneous number one single on the British and American charts, and it was called 10cc. And he simply said the next day, I'm calling you guys 10cc, like it or not. And he claims that there was no reference. It was not a wet dream, he said.
Right.
He said it was not any. It was just a number and two letters, and it didn't mean cubic.
It was supposed to be the amount of ejaculate.
Male ejaculate.
Yes.
I didn't want to go there.
That's what rumor was.
Right.
But I interviewed those guys many years ago. I'm not going to be precise on the date, but that's what they said, that it was the dream story,
right,
that the other thing was just rumor and not at all true.
Well, it's amazing how many bands will, they'll pick a name, haphazardly, or, someone in the band had their way, and then they realize they were stuck with it, and they either made up stories or, the fans made up stories mm-hmm. when the band wasn't forthcoming, and so this mythology grew around the band.
All right. Stuart, thanks for the call. We've actually, Adam had a couple of people calling and asking about Death Cab for Cutie, so that was obviously a big name for our audience here. Adam Dulgens is author of the book Band Names, From ABBA to ZZ Top. Let's take a call from TC here in New York. Hi, TC.
Hey there. I wanted to talk about a couple of bands. UB40 is one of them, because I always thought they had a really interesting way that they found their name.
Yeah. You have that one at hand, Adam?
That was the unemployment benefits form in England, and, unemployment at the time was rampant in England, so...
I heard that all the members of the band were actually unemployed when they formed the band.
I had heard that, too, yeah.
Yeah.
Again, who knows where rumor... it's sort of like the gangster rappers, I was shot five times when I was 12,
Yeah.
It's interesting to think who that might appeal to as an audience.
Right. Well, it's also one of those, UB40, I probably to the American audience doesn't mean, it's like U2 or REM. You don't really, you can impute whatever you want.
Well, I want to ask you about U2 because it's a piece of military hardware.
Right. Well,
and I never understood why such a pacifist leaning band.
They were a young band and they were looking for, advice similar to the Beatles. And I think it was the lead singer of another Dublin band that was more successful who said, the name that whatever name they had at the time or were considering, he said, that's rubbish. You need something strong. You need something, memorable. And, U2, while it could be a reference to a spy plane, there are also any other number of references. You can think of it as inclusive. Like you also.
Yes, I didn't know if it might be that. There was one other that I wanted to mention. If you have a second,
sure.
And that was the band that was the first band on the Apple label. And that's Badfinger.
Right.
And I never quite understood the reference.
I have to open the book and check because I did interview. One of the members of the band, and
the book is called Band Names, by the way, From ABBA to ZZ Top, and Adam Dulgens is my guest on Soundcheck. If you can't get through on the phone lines, you can email us soundcheck info@wnyc.org. And if you have stories of band names that you think are particularly successful or dramatically unsuccessful, email us and we'll have that on our next letters segment. All right, so Adam, Badfinger.
So it was the head of Apple Records at the time who came up with the name. Again, it was an external name. It was apparently, allegedly, it was from an old blues record called Badfinger Boogie, a piano record, as they said. And they were, I think they were called the Ivies at the time. And he said it's sort of a shabby kind of name.
Okay. All right. I'm kind of surprised. I mean, we're out of time, and I'm sorry, there are a lot of people on the line. No one apparently has asked about Three Dog Night, which to me, you know, growing up as a kid, you know, was like, what the heck is Three Dog Night? You got a quick answer before
sure.
we go?
Well, the short answer is in the Australian outback, it's an Aboriginal term. You know, if it's a very, very cold night, it's a three dog night because you need to sleep with three dogs up against you to keep you warm.
I get
but
it.
That was, I think, taken from like a National Geographic article. The lead singer's girlfriend said, how about this? And they said, well, why not?
Cool. Pass the bong. Three dog night sounds just fine to me. Yeah.
Precisely.
Broken Social Scene joining us in a moment. What do you think of that name?
I think it's a great name. I'd love to know how they got it.
All right. We'll do a little research for you for the next edition of the book in just a moment.
Excellent.
We've been speaking to Adam Dulgens. The book is Band Names, from ABBA to ZZ Top. Thanks to everyone who called. Email us if you like, soundcheck@wnyc.org. Broken Social Scene, 15 members strong. We got a couple of them representing this traveling music party. Joining us in just a moment, this is Soundcheck.
Hi, kids. Do you like Primus?
Yeah,
wanna
yeah.
see me stick 9-inch nails to each one of my eyelids?
Uh-huh.
Wanna copy me and do exactly like I did? Uh-huh. Try this shit and get messed up worse than my life is? My brain's dead weight. I'm trying to get my head straight, but I can't figure out which Spice Girl I want to impregnate. And Dr. Dre said,
Slim Shady, you a beauty.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Their first album was released less than 5 years ago, but the Canadian group called Broken Social Scene has already been through it all, it seems. This 15-member indie band has broken up a couple of times. Some members split. They've toured the world more than once. They've done a film soundtrack. They've even created their own label. Two of the original members are here with us today, Andrew Whiteman and John Crossingham. Guys, did I leave anything out?
Nope, sounds good, John.
Yeah, it'll work.
Yeah. So the band is called Broken Social Scene. Now, you know, I guess we'll do a little research for the next edition of Adam's book. Where does the name come from?
Well, that came, the very first Broken Social Scene record was done by the two founding members, Kevin and Brendan. And so they kind of had the name maybe intact then. The first actual gig that ever happened was Justin Parra plays drums, Brendan, Kevin, myself, and Leslie Feist. And we kicked around a whole bunch of names. They weren't sure if they wanted to use Broken Social Scene because they were about to put a record, and now we're going to do a live gig where they want to confuse people. But it just stuck. That's what we used, and that somehow mirrors, reflects every single thing we do.
Well, the funny thing is how well it seems to suit what the band is, which is not like a steady lineup, but rather this kind of rotating collective. I mean, I said 15 members. I could have said virtually any number between 1 and 30, and it seems like it it might have worked.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how does that work?
Well, I mean, I think you have to just have a relaxed approach to it and not not put too much of a constraint on anything. The original, I mean, Andrew mentioned how they weren't sure if they wanted to attach the name Broken Social Scene to that live band, and they were about to put out a record, which was originally just mainly Brendan and Kevin. But when I first joined the band, which was fairly soon after the gigs that Andrew was talking about, it was a case of, all right, well, we're gonna have this record come out, and we're going to put together a band called Broken Social Scene. We're grabbing a bunch of people, and with the exception of a couple tunes, we're pretty much not going to play anything off the record. And I think even by that point, the whole idea that this was going to be a bit of an unusual concept as far as how bands normally operate was pretty firmly established, you know, right in the roots of everything.
Well, and in virtually everything you guys have done, it's been unconventional. You just did these three nights at Webster Hall. And sorry, I've spent two of the last three nights at Carnegie Hall, so I'm a little, I'm not sure where I am. But, you know, at one point in your shows, you know, there's like six guitarists out on stage.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You've got a string section. You've got a horn section. You have two drummers. This is a rock band that needs and has a conductor.
Kind of, yeah. We've we've just been lucky in terms of the people that are in our group, the forces that we can draw on. Everyone, for some reason, seems to be very interested in listening to other people. Do you know, when I think of the people that are within the family of musicians, and these are people from arts and crafts or outside, like there's a Canadian band, Do Make Say Think, that are directly involved, Stars and Feist and Deers and there's Metric. There's just, these people are really good musicians.
Right.
So when you're sitting in a room, you know, you're in the basement, you're working stuff out. We're really trying, a lot of the songs in the beginning did come from an instrumental perspective. So you got to keep your ears wide open, and you really don't want to step on anyone else. You want to try and make it good. So when we have six guitar players sounding like one guitar player, that's the product of touring really hard for 3 years and doing a lot of listening, you know? Plus, it's more fun that way, too.
Mm-hmm. So is part of it simply an inability to say no when someone says, hey, can I play on this?
No, we've learned to say no.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
No, I mean, all of us, both Andrew and I, are very heavily involved in our own projects, too. And there are times where, you know, we're not involved in what goes on in Broken Social Scene. But the unique thing about it is when you're gone for a while, it's not like you hand in your, you know, hand in your badge and all that. I mean, you're always a part of the group, and you don't want to, that angle gets played up as a real utopian thing sometimes in the press, which is a little dangerous too.
Yeah, yeah.
But the bottom line is, we are a group of musicians who are very sympathetic to each other's projects. We're interested in one another's projects, and we're really genuinely grateful for the fact that we get to play in a band like this, because let's face it, in the world of whatever rock and roll, whether it's indie or major label or whatever, bands like us just don't exist that often. You don't have these kinds of opportunities.
Yeah.
You know?
We weren't expecting any of this. Like John said, in the beginning, the first year of our existence, every show had an entirely different set list. We just never wanted to repeat ourselves, and the fact that people actually bought our first record, second record, the You Forgot It, took everyone by surprise. And so when people say, gee, how do you organize all the people? You guys are on the road. How does it work with being in the studio? How do you know? And the answer to all those questions is we don't. We don't really have, like, we attempt to organize, because if we didn't, it would really fall apart. But, you know, nothing ever happens the way it's planned to happen, especially mm-hmm. with this many people. And
well, and especially with everybody, almost everybody in the band being in other bands.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it really is kind of a collective. Now, the new CD has, you know, gotten some pretty good reviews. It's also gotten, I mean, frankly, I've seen one or two reviews that say, you know, the second record's bad. I mean, the usual thing.
Oh, yeah.
The second record was a pretty good record. How do you follow that? You don't want to repeat yourself, Andrew, you just said. So,
we're all really proud of the new record, because it's just such an accurate reflection of where we are and were personally. I mean, the record took 2.5 years to make. We were on tours and off tours. Then other people, like you know, I'd be working on a song and then I'd have to go on an Apostle of Hustle tour. I'd come back a few months later. Then that song was forgotten about, and then be back. We'd go on Broken Social Scene, goes on tour. I come back, and then I hear the song again. It's completely different, mm-hmm. but now, oh, we need you to add some more stuff on it. It was just that kind of a process, you know?
So I understand that the final track on the new CD, It's All Gonna Break is the name of it, is this 10-minute long excursion. I understand that that's like that has been substantially revised.
Well, we actually... I mean, to give you a little bit of an insight maybe into the process of how that band work or how the band works, that was originally actually a song that we were playing in the earliest incarnations of the band. It was one of the first vocal songs that Kevin really started singing. Right. And I was playing the main drum kit on it, and Justin was playing a little side kit. And we even tried recording a version when we did the You've Forgotten People sessions, and it ended up getting scrapped, as did about 10 or 12 other songs. But yeah, I mean, that's a song that's grown and expanded and changed, and the main skeleton of it has remained pretty much intact, but I think it embodies the whole idea that some songs exist live for a while. Some Broken Social Scene songs, like a tune called Where's Your Heart or Jimmy and the Photocall, they may exist live exclusively for an eternity, aside from MP3s that are, you know, record off stage. There's no rush to commit things. It's a matter of timing. If things feel right to put them to tape, then we will. And whatever incarnation, meaning whatever the structure of the song is, whatever members are available at the time, whoever we're going to be recording with, whatever those circumstances are, that will form that version of it. But the songs are always in flux. And even once they're recorded, they're always changing.
Well, we are speaking with two of the members of Canada's Broken Social Scene, Andrew Whiteman and John Crossingham. This is the song, It's All Gonna Break, from the new album by Broken Social Scene. Broken Social Scene's new CD is simply called Broken Social Scene, and with us in our soundcheck studio is Andrew Whiteman, who plays guitar, a little bass. John Crossingham plays guitar and drums. Andrew, you mentioned before that, you know, you play with this other band, Apostle of Hustle.
Yeah.
What happens to Apostle of Hustle when, you know, Broken Social Scene is touring, and then what happens, I guess, Broken Social Scene with so many people, they just, when you're out with your other band, they just, you know, troop merrily along, but...
Yeah, well, what's happened so far, I mean, there's no rules, but what happened so far is that, and this is a good example of, you know, our family situation is, Apostle Hustle is essentially a trio, and one of the other members in the trio is basically riding his bike all the time. He's really into cycling, so he likes having a break, and the other one, Julian Brown, he's playing in Leslie Feist's band right now.
Who is also a member of Broken.
Who's also a member of Broken.
So
and Leslie's working her butt off, and, you know, she's always touring. So it's kind of working out right now. Julie and I are taking a break in March to record a new record, at which point I think Charles Spearin from Social Scene and from Do Make Say Think maybe will step in and tour with Leslie for that couple of weeks when Julian's not available, because Charles is now taking a break.
Now you
see, just, there you go, exactly.
You're making my head spin. Yeah.
So that's how it works, though.
So yeah. There's nothing broken about this Social Scene. It's like everybody knows everybody else, and, you know, you all make it work out somehow. What about, you must be heartily sick of the whole Canadian invasion thing, but, you know...
Yeah. Let's not go there, maybe.
But, I mean, you know, New Pornographers is another band that takes people from different groups and puts them together, and they've done quite well for mm-hmm. themselves. So, and then there's the whole jam band tradition. Now, you stick a 10-minute piece at the end of a record, and, you know, you've got six guitarists and 15 players and, you know, drums and stuff. People are, you know, going to wonder about that.
I don't know. I would just... you could also think of a 10-minute song. I kind of think of It's All Gonna Break, for example, as a 10-minute song, more like maybe from The Kids Are All Right. You wouldn't call The Who a jam band, but a quick one while he's away is certainly a 10 or 15-minute song with a million little parts to it, right?
Yeah, I think it's... I mean, Broken Social Scene certainly has some tendencies that allow us to stretch out as players, but the thing that I think gets lost when you talk about the nature of the production of the record and the length of some of the songs and the sprawling membership and everything is the fact that essentially these songs are all really tightly written pop songs. They're all melodic. They've all got hooks. They've all got, well, a great majority of them have verses and choruses, and they're pop tunes. You know, I mean, we play them in a slightly unconventional manner, but we're certainly not a jam band. It's not like we're Fish or the Grateful Dead or...
where there's,
you know,
like long meandering solos, you know, and stuff, yeah.
If you watch us, I mean, it's everything's pretty intact.
Okay. The band is called Broken Social Scene, and they've just finished three nights at Webster Hall here in New York, three sold-out performances. They'll be on NBC's Late Night with Conan O'Brien tomorrow night. And the CD is on the Arts and Crafts label. It's called Broken Social Scene. Andrew Whiteman, John Crossingham, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, John.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast of Soundcheck from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This was just one of the show's segments. You can hear everything we do on demand at WNYC.org. Check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.